Once again, we've got our brother Sam with us this evening to continue his studies on the book of Ephesians. This evening it is Ephesians chapter 5. So as the obvious introduction to our brother Sam's comments this evening, we will be reading from Ephesians chapter 5. With that reading, I'll now ask our brother Sam to come and lead us in his study of Ephesians chapter 5. Thanks, Sam.
Thanks, John, and good evening, everyone. So last time, I think we saw that the truth, living the truth, is really all about change. It's all about transformation. But the transformation has to begin in the spirit of the mind. So it's got to start with our attitudes, with our motives. It's no good just changing our actions. So the Colossians had fallen for that trap. They'd just changed their actions. But Paul doesn't want the Ephesians going down that same path. So he's been a great pains to sort of lay a correct foundation for this new way of life. And he talks about in chapter 3, verse 17, about being rooted and grounded in love. He talks about meekness and long-suffering and forbearing, all those emotions, forbearing each other in love in chapter 4 and verse 2. He talks about the spirit, the attitude of the ecclesia that's so important for ecclesial unity in chapter 4 and verse 3. And he talks about this idea of edifying and growing and building the ecclesia. And he talks about that in chapter 4 and verse 12 and 15 and 16. So he's not talking about a growth in ecclesial numbers. It's growth in love. It's growth in the characteristic of love. For example, if you have a look at verse 15 of chapter 4, he says, "But speaking the truth in love may grow up." And in verse 16, "Every part maketh increase of the body unto the edifying, the building of itself in love." So God's not worried about ecclesial numbers, but he is worried about the growth of the character of each individual body part. So he wants quality, not quantity necessarily. And finally, we looked at that pivotal verse in verse 23 of chapter 4, "Be renewed in the spirit of our minds." So this is where change has to start. It has to start in the attitude, the thinking. And that's going to translate into action, as we'll see this evening. So this evening we're going to start looking at specific areas of our life that need to change. And that change is going to be visible. It's going to be obvious to other people. And we know it's visible because Paul calls us lights. Have a look at chapter 5 and verse 8. He doesn't say there that ye have seen the light or that ye are in the light. He says, "But ye were sometimes darkness, but now are ye light in the Lord. Walk as children of light." So it's not that we've seen the light or that we're in the light, but we are the lights. Wherever we go, whatever we do, without necessarily saying a word, people in this world of darkness should see light beaming out from us. I think it was Shane Kirkwood who once said, "We're the only Bible that most people are ever going to see." So light can't be hid, and as Christ tells us, as we know on the Sermon on the Mount. So true inner spiritual change that we saw in verse 23 of chapter 4 is always going to be revealed on the outside. If we're rooted and grounded in love, then we're inevitably going to produce the fruit of the Spirit. And James makes that clear for us too, doesn't he? He says in chapter 2 and verse 14, "What doth it profit, my brethren, though a man say he hath faith and hath not works, can faith save him?" And really James is asking, can that faith save? And if you look at any other translation, the RV or the ESV or Young's Literal, they all translate it that way. Can that type of faith save us? Can a faith that produces no works save you? Well, clearly not, because in reality that's no faith at all. As verse 17 says, "Even so faith, if it hath not works, is dead, being alone." So a faith that doesn't produce any works is dead. And our dead faith is really no faith at all, isn't it? So if we don't produce actions, works, if you like, light that can be seen on the outside, then we know that we haven't really changed on the inside, no matter what we might say. So it's the change on the inside that saves us, of course, but it's always going to be evident on the outside. So Paul begins this theme of putting off and putting on. And we started to look at that last time. So we talked about putting off the old, putting off the corrupt, putting off the deceitful, and then contrasting that with putting on the new, putting on the created and putting on the true. So this is the transformation in lifestyle that Paul wants to see in the Ephesians and in us to go along with this huge change of status that he's talked about. So just as their relationship with God has moved from death into life, from darkness into light, from aliens to fellow citizens, so too their lifestyle needs to undergo an equally dramatic change. And Romans 12 really talks about this idea of putting off the bad to put on the good, doesn't it? It's not enough to rid ourselves of the bad, we need to replace it with good. And we'll see as Paul goes through this next section the various examples he chooses in the next 30 verses or so. So he talks about in verse 25 of chapter 4, putting away lying and putting on or speaking every man truth to his neighbour. In verse 28 he talks about putting off, stealing no more, put off the stealing, instead labour and give to those in need. So that's what we need to put on. We put off corrupt communication in verse 29, and we put on that which is good or edifying. So we take off corruptness and we put on good edifying talk. Verse 31 and 32, let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamour and evil speaking be put away. So that's what we put off. What do we put on? We put on kindness, tenderheartedness and forgiveness for each other. Then he continues in chapter 5, verse 3 and 4, we put off fornication, uncleanness, covetousness, filthiness, fawning, talking and jesting, and we put on the giving of thanks. In verse 11, we put off fellowship with the works of darkness, and instead we put on, we reprove them. Chapter 5 and verse 15, we put off walking as a fool, and then we put on walking as wise. In verse 17, we put off unwisdom, that's a word for sure, and we put on the understanding of God's will. In verse 18, we put off being drunk, and we put on being spirit-filled. So some of these ideas are, I guess, fairly obvious, perhaps. We put off lying and we put on speaking the truth. That seems fairly clear, doesn't it? But some of them are a bit more obscure. So fornication, for example, gets replaced with thankfulness. And we'll have a look at the reasons for that as well. So the idea of putting off the bad and putting on the good is, of course, both sides of the atonement too, isn't it? It's one thing to condemn sin, it's another thing to do the right thing. Now, this section that we're going to go through can, I guess, act as a bit of a checkpoint for us, I guess. Have we really changed? Have we undergone that transformation, that renewal that Paul's talked about in chapter 4 and verse 23? Do we really have faith? Are we really building up in love? Well, this section is really going to test that. Are we putting off fleshly and natural and selfish characteristics? Well, if not, perhaps we really haven't begun that transformation process. Are we putting on godly, Christly, also a word, spiritual characteristics? If not, well, maybe we really haven't begun to develop the faith and the hope and the love that we need in our minds. So let's start at verse 25 of chapter 4. Wherefore, putting away lying, speak every man truth with his neighbours, for we are members one of another. So this phrase, the idea of the members one of another, should really remind us of this, this body analogy that Paul's been using throughout the book. So he's used the idea of the ecclesia being a body, and we are members of that body. So that's the idea behind being members one of another here. So can one body part lie to another body part? Well, Christ sort of uses a hyperbolic analogy when he says, don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. Don't let your left hand know what your right hand's doing. Literally, of course, it can't be done. Our body knows what the rest of the body's doing. All of our consciousness passes through the brain. So there's no way, if you broke a finger, for example, that that finger can't tell the brain that it's in pain. It can't lie to the rest of the body, can it? The entire body feels the pain of that finger. So any injury, any illness, any pleasure, on the other hand, is felt or at least transmitted through your entire body. And that's how we should be as members of the one ecclesial body as well. So he's specifically talking about lying within the ecclesia here as members one of the other. Not, of course, that it's okay to lie at other times. So Paul starts his list of examples with lying. Why does he start with this? Why is this the most important issue of putting off and putting on for Paul to address it first? Well, keep in mind that the key aspect of the body that he's been dealing with is, or at least one of the key aspects, is dealing with the unity of the body, its oneness. So chapter 4 and verse 4, for example, there's one body amongst all the other things that he lists as one there. And chapter 4 and verse 13, all come in the unity of the faith. So this idea of the one body, the unity of the faith, the unity of the body is paramount to Paul. And Paul knows that there's no sin like deceit or lying within the ecclesial body to destroy that unity. Well, how does Paul know that? Well, because he knew that the first open sin in the new ecclesial body after Christ's death and resurrection was a case of lying, the case of Ananias and Sapphira. So we read about that, and I think we know the story pretty well from Sunday school days, perhaps, Acts chapter 5. It's not really Ananias and Sapphira keeping back the money that disturbed Peter so, but the lie that they told. So Acts chapter 5 and verse 3, there he talks about them lying to the Holy Spirit. And in verse 4, he says, "Thou hast not lied unto men, but unto God." So Ananias and Sapphira told a lie and paid for it with their life, which seems fairly drastic to us, doesn't it? And yet, I think that lying is so undermining of the trust, and trust is such an essential part of our unity as a body, as an ecclesial body, that this sin, this error, we might not even see it as a particularly bad sin, just telling a small lie about how much money we got for a block of land. This sin was punishable by death. So the unity of the body is so directly threatened by lying that Peter sort of instantaneously and permanently amputates those two members of the body that undermine the trust that had existed in the ecclesia. And their punishment was death. Now, of course, it doesn't have to be an outright lie to lose trust between brethren. You know, even suspicious of sort of duplicitous motives is going to destroy trust in an ecclesia. So open and true communication is the key of a good relationship between brothers and sisters and between ecclesias as well. And any undermining of that, any undermining of that by lying, or not even necessarily quite lying, but intending to deceive, is going to be so destructive. So lies don't even have to be spoken, do they? A duplicitous lifestyle is a lie in itself. So if we're one thing at the meeting and something else at work or at home, then that's going to undermine any trust our brothers and sisters have in us, and so undermine the unity of the body that we enjoy here as well. If we say one thing at the meeting but live something else in our lives, in our private lives, then that sort of deceit is going to undermine the unity of the body. And as soon as our brothers and sisters see that we're not who we say we are, then any credibility, any trust is going to go straight out the window. And we've seen in, I guess, recent ecclesial history how duplicitous behaviour completely undermines and all the positive things that any seemingly previously upright brothers have done in the past. And back in Acts chapter 2 and verse 46, we've got quite a contrast there, haven't we? How the ecclesia is described back in the first century at the beginning, it's described as continuing daily with one accord in the temple. So we've got this unique unity back then. And breaking of bread from house to house, and did eat their meat with gladness and singleness of heart. So before Ananias and Sapphira came along, they were of one accord, partly because they had singleness of heart. So they weren't duplicitous, they were sincere. What you saw was what you got. There was an openness, an honesty between them. And as soon as that was broken by Ananias and Sapphira, by their lies, by their deceit, by their double standards, their hypocrisy, then the unity of the body was lost. And the remedy to lying, of course, is logically speaking the truth, as Paul says in chapter 4 and verse 25. And Paul's already mentioned that in chapter 4 and verse 15. Remember back there he said speaking the truth in love. So he's already talked about telling the truth And now he just contrasts it to the sin of lying. The second issue that Paul confronts is that of anger. Verse 26, "Be ye angry and sin not," it says in the Authorised Version. "Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, neither give place to the devil." And you note that he revisits this idea of anger management, I guess, in verse 31 of the chapter. "Let all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamour and evil speaking be put away from you with all malice." And even though there's only two different words there in the King James Version, there's a variety of different Greek words that are used in those couple of verses as well. Now, verse 26 is a bit of an odd verse, isn't it? Paul says, "Be angry." Like, be angry. It sounds like Paul's sort of encouraging us to be angry here. But his words in verse 31 are clearly saying that anger and wrath are something that we need to put away. Now, the conjunction there in verse 26, "Be angry and sin not," there's translated "and" in the Authorised Version, but in English could equally be translated as "but." So, in other words, be angry but sin not. Let not the sun go down in your wrath. And I think that Paul's comments about anger are really flowing from his comments about speaking truth to our neighbour in verse 25. So we're putting away lying, but we're speaking truth to our neighbour. And sometimes we need to speak truths that are have perhaps about things that have made us angry, particularly if the truth contains perhaps a warning about their way of life, for example. And sometimes that anger is justified, but as verse 15 told us, any truth telling that we need to do needs to be done in love. So compassionately, meekly, forbearing each other. Now, we know that anger is not a sin in itself. We know that God gets angry. We know that Christ got angry as well. But the difference, of course, is that their anger was justifiable. We might call it, you know, righteous anger. And I think Paul is here sort of allowing for the fact that that occasionally anger is justifiable, but that it's very rare, and much more often it's actually a sin. So I'll go out on a limb here and say that 99% of the time that we get angry, it's nothing more than our own selfishness flaring up. We've been inconvenienced in some way. It's not anger at someone breaking God's laws, but a reaction to perhaps the pain of our own pride being hurt. So is that justifiable? Is that righteous anger? Well, of course it's not. It's merely an expression of our own selfishness at the end of the day. So Paul gives us two tests, I think, to make sure that our anger is possibly justified. So the first test is don't let the sun go down on your wrath. So don't let your anger stew. Don't feed it. Do I still feel angry at the end of the day? Has that anger festered and brewed inside me for hours? If we've nursed that anger, then it's much more likely to be a self-centred anger than a God-centred anger. And the second test is don't give place to the devil. So don't let your anger become an excuse or perhaps a gateway for sin. Anger might be justified, but don't let it become something uncontrolled or rash. Don't let it lead to further sin. If our anger is unrestrained and we wind up saying something that we know that's going to hurt someone else, for example, then it's pretty unlikely to be a righteous anger. Now, if we can pass those two tests, perhaps then our anger is justified. But Paul is really showing that anger is very rarely justified and much more likely to be an expression of our own selfishness. Psalm 37 says these words. It says, "Rest in Yahweh and wait patiently for him. Fret not thyself because of him who prospereth in his way, because of the man who bringeth wicked devices to pass. Cease from anger, forsake wrath. Fret not thyself in any wise to do evil. For evildoers shall be cut off, but those that wait upon Yahweh, they shall inherit the earth." And Paul's really echoing the words of this psalm, I think. "Fret not thyself to do evil," says the psalmist. In other words, don't give place to the devil, as Paul puts it. Don't let anger become the root of another issue. Even if your anger is against someone who's bringing wicked devices to pass, as the psalmist says, it might be justified, but don't let it become the basis of some evil that can't be justified. Instead, the psalmist says, rest, wait patiently, fret not, wait upon the Lord. And that's his solution to anger. Verse 29 of Ephesians 4 tells us, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying, that it may minister grace unto the hearers. So we're going to put off corrupt communication, and instead we're going to put on that which is good, that which ministers grace to the hearers. Now, there's a bit of a theme for Paul in this section, a theme of what comes out of our mouth. And that's going to become a bit of a key here from in verse 29 and again in verse 31. And it continues into chapter 5 as well. So in verse 29, he talks about corrupt communication. The ESV has corrupt talk. The Greek word really means rotten. So corruption is something that tears down. And Paul's been all about building up and edifying, hasn't he, in chapter 4. So he's not talking about, you know, dirty talk here, which he does a little bit later. Instead, it's anything destructive that comes out of our mouth, anything that we say that tears someone down rather than builds someone up. It could be criticism, it could be gossip, it could be the truth even, but delivered in a way that's destructive to other people. And he picks it up again in verse 31, and he talks about clamour and evil speaking. Now, clamour just means a loud noise, so perhaps shouting in anger, perhaps, per the context. Perhaps we're all occasionally tempted to yell at someone in our annoyance, perhaps at a fellow road user, perhaps, who's driving too slowly or too fast or too closely or not indicating. Well, not a good idea, says Paul. So don't indulge in clamour, making loud noises, shouting. Evil speaking, that refers really to slander. In other words, denigrating other people, running them down in front of others. And often, again, that is the result of anger with that person, but of course it's still unjustifiable. Then in chapter 5 and verse 4, he talks about other things that we can say, other things that come out of our mouth, filthiness, foolish talking, and jesting. Now, filthiness does mean obscenities. Foolish talking, according to Strong's, means buffoonery. That's quite nice too. So silly talk or buffoonery, again, so talk doesn't have to be, you know, dirty talk to be destructive. Even sort of a seemingly light-hearted humour can reveal the speaker to be a fool or a buffoon. And if that's the only thing that anyone ever contributes to the conversation, that may well be the only thing that that person is. So jesting is another one in chapter 5 and verse 4, and the ESV has for that one crude joking. So this is talking about filthy talking, which might be unacceptable in a worldly social setting, but often, of course, it's masked by and made acceptable by innuendo or double entendre, nudge, nudge, wink, wink type of humour. And, of course, that's more socially acceptable, but the intention, of course, is exactly the same as blatant obscenity. So Paul tells us in chapter 5 and verse 4 that this sort of talk is not convenient, or as the RSV has it, not proper, not befitting. So Paul says this sort of talk is not befitting. If we claim to be holy people, what comes out of our mouth should also be holy. Otherwise, of course, we've got a mismatch. So Christ tells us similar words, doesn't he, in Luke chapter 6 and verse 45. A good man out of the good treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is good, and an evil man out of the evil treasure of his heart bringeth forth that which is evil. And how does it come out? How do we know what's in the heart? From the abundance of the heart his mouth speaketh. So if we want to know what's in someone's heart, we just have to listen to them for long enough, and we're eventually going to find out. People can only cover up an unholy heart with holy speaking for so long. Eventually the truth is going to come out in what we say. So what we say is really important, and we can't talk about what we say without referring, of course, to the book of James again. And James likens the mouth to a very destructive element. In chapter 1 and verse 26, he talks about if any man seem to you to be religious and bridleth not his tongue. So if he can't control what he says, then he's deceiving his own heart, and that man's religion is vain. chapter 3 and verse 6, he talks about the tongue being a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members that it defileth the whole body and setteth on fire the course of nature and is set on fire of hell. And in verse 8 of the same chapter, but the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. So how destructive is the tongue, or how destructive can the tongue be? Because it can also be used, of course, to build and to edify. Well, James says it can light a bushfire. And we've all seen that happen, I think, I guess, in ecclesial history. A couple of choice, destructive words in the ear of the right person, and soon the whole ecclesia is in flames. It doesn't have to be crude talk. It doesn't have to be slander even, or lies. It can even be the truth. But even the truth told in the right way can be so destructive. The gossip, the implication of our words, the evil that we want our hearer to infer about the subject we've talked about, it might be masked by a sort of claimed concern for that person that we're talking about, but we know in our hearts and our minds when our words are intended to wound or undermine or disparage someone. And that sort of thing, of course, spreads through an ecclesia from member to member, especially amongst Christadelphians, and especially in our day of sort of rapid electronic communication, it spreads like the fire that James talks about. Well, what's the remedy to all that destructiveness? Well, our words need to edify, don't they? They need to build up and not corrupt. They need not to tear down. So we need to minister grace, literally serve up grace with our mouths. Our mouths should build up with charis, with grace. So how do we do that? Well, we need to weigh our words, our tone, because, as my mother would of course say, it's not just what you say, it's how you say it. The tone, what we imply, what we say, and perhaps what we leave out as well. All these things are important. And the question that we need to ask ourselves is, what's the effect of our words going to be on the hearer and on the subject? Is it going to build the hearer up? Is what we're saying to this person going to build them up? Is their faith going to be stronger when they hear what we have to say, or is it going to be weaker? Is their love for their brothers and sisters going to be stronger when they hear what we have to say, or is it going to be weaker? And what about the person we're talking about? Is their faith or love going to be stronger or weaker as a result of this conversation? They might never hear the conversation, but because of the power of the tongue, they're inevitably going to feel the effects of that conversation. What will that effect be? Will it be to build up, or will it be to tear down? Will it increase love and faith and hope, or will it decrease? And what about God himself? How's he going to respond to our conversation when he overhears it? In chapter 4 and verse 30, Paul talks about grieving not the Holy Spirit of God. So will our words grieve God? Is that what they're going to do? And it doesn't take huge amounts of intelligence to be able to tell the difference between what we say, whether it's going to be destructive or whether it's going to be edifying, whether it's going to destroy or build up. But it does take some wisdom to be able to stop and weigh the effect of what we're going to say to others before we actually speak. Now, verse 31 talks about bitterness and wrath and anger. So we want to just concentrate on this idea of bitterness for a little bit. So you can imagine the Ephesian ecclesia reading through this epistle that Paul's written to them, this letter, and he tells them in chapter 1 and verse 3 that they've been blessed with all spiritual blessings in heavenly places in Christ. Well, that sounds pretty cool, doesn't it? And then he tells them in verse 18 of chapter 1 that we've received the riches and the glory of the inheritance of Christ and seen the exceeding greatness of his power. And that sounds great. And in chapter 2 and verse 6, he says that we've been raised up to sit in heavenly places in Christ Jesus. And that in verse 17, we've had peace preached to us. So you can imagine the Ephesians hearing all these words about this great new life they have in the ecclesia, and thinking, well, I don't feel at peace. I don't feel like I'm sort of sitting in heavenly places. I don't feel any richer in inheritance than I did before. In fact, my life is as average or perhaps even worse than it was before. Paul's promised all these great spiritual blessings to us, and yet my current life seems worse than it was before. And that feeling, of course, could lead to bitterness. So I'm sure we've all felt bitterness before, that sort of nasty, negative feeling that we get when things aren't going so well for us. The feeling that perhaps we've been done hard done by. The feeling that perhaps life is better for pretty much everyone else but us. The feeling that perhaps God has forgotten us or is trying to try us above our capacity. Sometimes we think that it's our right to feel aggrieved about life. And of course, as Malcolm Fraser taught us, life wasn't meant to be easy. But sometimes we feel aggrieved about life a lot. Surely we're allowed to feel a little bit of bitterness every now and then. Well, what's the issue with bitterness? Why does Paul list it amongst the things that we've got to put off in Ephesians chapter 4? Well, effectively, it's a symptom of self-pity, which in turn is essentially selfishness. So remember the last time when we looked about looking up and growing up? Bitterness is a result of not looking up towards Christ, but looking around, seeing how everyone else is doing and comparing ourselves among ourselves, as Paul puts it in Corinthians. And as a result, we might feel that perhaps we're not doing as well as every other person we see. So bitterness is really a direct result of looking around instead of keeping our head up, the focus on our head, who of course is Christ, who had no possessions, nowhere to lay his head, and every waking moment was spent in the service of others who were pretty much unthankful and ungrateful for his sacrifice. So if anyone had a right to feel embittered, it was Christ, but of course he did not. So our life, our joy, which is sort of the opposite to bitterness, I guess, our attitude towards life should not be dependent on our circumstances. Bitterness is what we feel when we can only concentrate on our immediate circumstances. And there's an interesting quote from Colin Attridge's book on the fruit of the Spirit. And he talks about the fact that too many people live under the illusion that their inner peace is dependent on what goes on outside of them. So if we're dependent on our peace by what our circumstances are, our immediate circumstances, then it's not going to be great. He says it goes beyond what is naturally reasonable for us to rejoice in the Lord always. It's beyond what would naturally be reasonable for us. And yet that's what God calls us to. When we learn to praise God, come rain or shine, then he says we've found real peace. When we know and trust that our whole lives are ordered by God, we learn to see him even in the bad events of life and not only in the good. To complain about the bad is to complain about what God is doing to bring us closer to him. Now, of course, that's all very easy to say when things are going well, but it's not quite so easy to say, let alone practice, of course, when things are falling apart. And Job's a classic example of someone who became fairly consumed with bitterness. He talks about his soul being weary of his life. Now, I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say unto God, and he's bitter against God. There's no sort of two ways about it. Do not condemn me. Show me wherefore thou contendest with me. It is good. Is it good unto thee, God, that thou shouldest oppress, that thou shouldest despise the work of thine hands and shine upon the counsel of the wicked? So Job is bitter against God here. He doesn't understand what God is doing or why he's doing it. And his immediate circumstances have made him lose focus on the big picture and concentrate on what is happening to him today and now instead of what is going to happen to him in the long term. And the result, of course, is bitterness against God himself. Well, that's a dangerous way to think, says Paul. Not only dangerous, but wrong. We really have to have the faith that realises that God is working with us, with his ecclesia in the good and the bad, probably really especially in the bad things that happen to us. So bitterness is really a key danger in Paul's writings here. The rest of the negative qualities in this verse really spring out of bitterness. Bitterness that can then lead to wrath and anger perhaps, anger even with ourselves, perhaps with others, perhaps with God himself, as was the case with Job. And that in turn can lead to clamour, literally making loud noises, shouting, yelling, screaming, evil speaking, or slander, as the ESV has. So when our bitterness turns to anger, we might feel the need to vent that anger by yelling at someone, or even worse, might start to slander those who we feel aren't doing as tough as us or could be helping us but don't seem to be. So what's the solution to all this? Well, Ephesians 4 verse 32 tells us the solution is to put on being kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. So we put away bitterness and wrath and clamour and evil speaking, and we put on being kind, being tender-hearted and forgiving. So what's the solution to bitterness and all those attendant responses to that? Well, Paul says the solution is to focus on other people, be kind to other people, tender-hearted, forgiving. The solution to feeling bitter about our lot in life is not to concentrate on our lot in life, but to do what we can to alleviate other people's lots in life. So look not on our own needs, on our own wants, on our own perceived lack of blessing, but every man on the things of others. Tender-heartedness is the opposite to bitterness. It's the cure for bitterness. Bitterness is all about me compared to you, whereas tender-heartedness is all about you. So he tells us to be followers then of God as dear children, therefore. So it's not a great place for the chapter break in chapter 5 and verse 1, because we've got that important conjunction therefore once again. So the logic here is pretty apparent. So he talks about forgiveness as Christ has forgiven you in verse 32 of chapter 4. Be kind, forgiving, even as God for Christ's sake hath forgiven you. Be ye therefore followers of God as dear children. So just as Christ and God have forgiven you, then so we need to do to other people as well. How are we to follow God? In his attitude of forgiveness and kindness and tender-heartedness. So we follow God and we walk as Christ, as verse 2 says. We follow God, we walk as Christ. The same idea in both of those. And then in chapter 32 of verse 32 of chapter 4, we do it even as God. So our model in all these things is the Father and the Son. But he tells us in chapter 5 and verse 3, but all fornication and uncleanness and covetousness, let it not be once named among you as becometh saints. So the next thing that we need to put off is lust in all its forms. So he gives us lots of different examples of that in verse 3 and verse 5 of chapter 5. But the one thing that he repeats a couple of times in both verse 3 and verse 5 is covetousness, interestingly. So in verse 3 he talks about covetousness and in verse 5 about the covetous man. So covetousness is included among with whoremongers and unclean persons, not just once but twice. And we might think, well, you know, covetousness isn't that bad perhaps. But Paul does this elsewhere in 1 Corinthians a couple of times. He also lists it among with covetousness, amongst with fornicators and extortioners and idolaters. So there might be a sin that perhaps we wink at, to use a phrase from Acts chapter 17. We might overlook it because everyone does it. And in fact, our whole society is really built around covetousness, wanting more and wanting better and wanting faster. And yet Paul lists it here in Ephesians amongst, you know, sins like male prostitution and lewdness. So he's really underlining the importance of this sin of covetousness. So what's the solution to all these things, all these ideas of lust, whether it's sexual or whether it's covetousness, lust for things? Well, the solution that Paul talks about is thankfulness. So we're back to putting off the bad and putting off the good. We're putting off fornication and uncleanness and covetousness and filthiness and foolish talking and jesting in verse 4. What replaces all of those things? What do we put on to replace those things? Well, Paul says it's thankfulness. Thankfulness is the antidote that he suggests to all these things. It's not self-control or self-denial, but Paul says thankfulness. One simple attitude change can, according to Paul, have a big impact on all these, what might seem to us to be completely unrelated, bad characteristics. And he reinforces again in verse 20. He talks about, of chapter 5, giving thanks always for all things. So this idea of thankfulness is really important to the Apostle Paul. How does that work to overcome all the bad things that he's mentioned in verse 3 and verse 4 of chapter 5? Why is thankfulness such a powerful tool? Well, partly because it changes our focus from ourselves to others, and particularly, of course, to God. We're not thinking about what we want or how we're going to get what we want, but we're realising what we have and how we got what we have from our Father. And our focus goes from the earthly to the heavenly, doesn't it? Remember last time we talked about looking up and growing up? Well, thankfulness is a great way to start looking up towards God, who has given us all the things that we have to enjoy in this life. He talks about the need in verse 24, continual thankfulness. Wherever we are, whatever we're doing, there's always something to be thankful for. At the most basic level, we can thank God that we are alive from day to day. It gives us a positive mindset. Again, we're not focusing on what we don't have. And covetousness, of course, is a result of this, focusing on what we don't have and what we think we need. There's always something more, whether it's material or sexual or whatever. The eye isn't filled with seeing. And if we always focus on what we lack, then that's going to be a great source of anxiety and perhaps depression in our lives. The antidote to dissatisfaction with what we have is to be thankful for what we have and not to focus on what we don't have. Thankfulness is linked academically in studies to mental health in people. It doesn't matter whether the thankfulness is to God. It didn't have to be a religious type of thankfulness, but thankful people are more positive and have lower incidence of mental health issues such as anxiety and depression. And of course, thankfulness forces us to look up towards God rather than looking down or in towards ourselves. If we're always thankful, then we're always going to be lifting up our minds to a spiritual level. And thankfulness will change what we do with what we have. If we're thankful for a pay packet, for example, then, of course, we're more likely to put some of it in the collection rather than spend it on ourselves. If we're thankful for time to ourselves, then I guess we're going to be more likely to spend it reading or meditating rather than just watching a movie. If we're thankful for friends or family, then we're going to be more likely to try and positively, spiritually influence them than otherwise. So being thankful for blessings in life is actually going to change how we use those blessings in a positive way. And thankfulness is something that he talks about in both Ephesians and Colossians as well, which we're not going to look at in any detail this evening. So that's where we're going to leave it for this evening. Next time we're going to pick it up again in God willing, in about verse 22, where he starts talking about those important relationships between wives and husbands, and then in chapter 6 between children and fathers and servants and masters, and we'll pick it up there, God willing, next time.